given that the sale of his estate has been appealed. It might signify to the widow if Crosbie Wells had a brother tucked away. Lauderback was smiling again, tremulously. The widow? Aye, Balfour said darkly, and was about to go on, but Lauderback said, all in a rush, There was no sign of a wife at the cottage, no sign at all. To all appearances, he, the fellow, lived alone. Indeed, Balfour said. Again he was about to elaborate, but Lauderback interrupted. You said that it might signify. News about a brother. But a man's money always goes to his wife, unless his will says otherwise. That's the law. I don't see how a brother could signify. I don't see it. He bent his head towards his guest. There is no will, Balfour said. That's the problem. Crosbie Wells never made one. No one knew if he had any family at all. They didn't even know where to send a letter when he passed. They only had his name, you see, not a home address, not even a birth certificate, nothing. So his landed cottage are returned to the Crown, and the Crown has the right to sell it on, of course. So it goes on the market and it sells the very next day. Nothing stays long on the market around here, I can tell you. But then, with the ink still drying on that sale, a wife turns up. No one knew a scrap about a wife before that day. Only she's got the marriage papers, and she signs herself Lydia Wells. Lauderback's eyes bulged. Now, at last, Thomas Balfour had his complete attention. Lydia Wells, he said, almost in a whisper. Augustus Smith looked at Jock, and then away. This was on Thursday, Balfour said, nodding. The court can't fault her papers. They've sent away to Dunedin, of course, just to verify. But something's off. The way she pops up so quickly, wanting to get her hands on the estate, when Crosbie never spoke of her. And another thing is fishy. This lady is a damn class act. How Crosbie Wells managed to get himself married to a lady like that, whew, is a mystery that I, for one, would pay to know the answer to. You've seen her. Lydia, here. She's here. The name was familiar in his mouth. So he knew her, Balfour thought. And he must have known the dead man, too. Aye, he said aloud, careful not to let any trace of his suspicion show. Coming off the packet steamer Thursday. Dressed up to the nines, she was. Swarming down the ladder like a regular salt. Dress in a knot over her shoulder, drawers gathered up in her hand, all the hoops and buckles on display. I'm blowed if I know how Crosbie Wells landed a piece like her. I'm blowed. Lauderback was still looking shocked. Lydia Wells? Wife of Crosbie Wells? Aye, so her story goes. Balfour studied his acquaintance, and then suddenly put down his glass and leant forward. "Look here, Mr. Lauderback," he said, placing his palm upon the table between them. "Seems you're holding on to something that's preventing you from talking plain. Why don't you share it?" This request, so simply made, unlocked a dam in Alistair Lauderback's heart. As is the case for so many governing men, who are accustomed to constant service of the highest quality, and who rarely find themselves alone, Lauderback tended to think of his attendants in utilitarian terms. Certainly Balfour was a nice enough chap, shrewd in his business, cheerfully intemperate and ready with a laugh, but his value as a man was equal to the value of the role he filled. In Lauderback's mind, he was replaceable. What lay beyond his most immediately visible qualities, the politician had never troubled himself to learn. It is always a starkly private moment when a governor first apprehends his subject as a man, perhaps not as an equal, but at least as a being, irreducible, possessed of frailties, enthusiasms, a real past, and an uncertain future. Alistair Lauderback felt that starkness now, and was ashamed. He saw that Balfour had offered friendship, and he had taken only assistance. That Balfour had offered kindness, and he had taken only the benefit of use. He turned to his aides.
"Fellows," he said, "I want to talk to Balfour man to man. Go and leave us for a spell." Augustus and Jock rose from the table. Balfour observed, with a flash of competitive triumph, unusual for him, that they both looked very put out, and left the dining room without a word. When they had gone, Lauderback exhaled deeply. He poured himself another measure of wine, but instead of taking a draught, he held the glass between the heels of his hands and stared at it.
"Do you miss England, Tom?" he said.
"England?" Balfour raised his eyebrows. "I haven't set foot in sunny England since, well, since before my hair was grey."
"Of course," Lauderback said apologetically.
"You were in California, I'd forgotten." He fell silent, chastising himself. "Round here, everybody's always talking about home," said Balfour. "Can't help but think that the pleasure's in the missing."
"Yes," said Lauderback, very quietly. "Just so."
"Why," Balfour went on, encouraged by the other man's assent, "most boys keep one foot on the boat, you know. Head back as soon as they've made their dust.
What do they do?
Buy a life, find a sweetheart, settle down.
And then what do they dream about? What do they wish for? They dream about the diggings. Back when they could hold the colour in their hands. When all they did here was talk about home. Their mothers, Yorkshire puddings, proper bacon, all of that."
He tapped the base of his glass upon the table.
"England? That's the old country. You miss the old country, of course you do. But you don't go back."
While he was waiting for the politician to begin speaking, he looked around him. It was well after 10 o'clock in the morning, and the dinner crowd had not yet begun to trickle in, which they would presently, for it was Saturday, and a Saturday following a week of rain. The boy at the hearth had gone, taking the rack of hot irons with him. The cook had put away his playing cards and was hacking at a bone. The scrubbing boys had surfaced from their quarters and were stacking plates and making noise. The cllergyman at the table next to theirs was still sitting at his coffee, which had long since cooled. His gaze was focused on the print of the pamphlet he held in his hand, and his mouth was pursed in concentration. It was clear that he was not paying his neighbours the slightest attention, but even so, Balfour brought his chair a little closer to Lauderback's, so that the politician would not have to speak so loud.
"Lydia Wells," Lauderback began, "is the mistress of an establishment in Dunedin, whose name I should like only to say once, if you don't mind. The place is called